I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you'd like to become a Patreon sponsor for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, go to our website, bodybuildinglegendshow.com, and you'll see the link in the upper right-hand corner to becoming a Patreon donor. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we got Bob Ciccarillo on the show, the voice of bodybuilding. We've never had Bob on the show before, but his career extends all the way back to the 1980s when he started competing as a teenager. Bob won the 1987 Junior Nationals at only like 21 years old, and then he was battling it out on the national scene to try to get his pro card for many, many years during those very tough late 1980, early, well, actually all of the 1990s. And Bob finally got his pro card at the 2000 NPC USA Championships, where he won the overall. So persistence paid off for Bob. And then Bob competed for several years as a professional bodybuilder. I think he did really well at the Night of the Champions one year. And he won the Masters World Pro, I believe, one year. And now he is known, of course, as the voice of bodybuilding because he is the MC for the Mr. Olympia and has been doing that job for several years. So Bob is really in the know as far as bodybuilding goes. And he goes way, like I said, he goes way back to the 1980s. So I thought it'd be great to have him on the show and talk a little bit about his career and about old school bodybuilding. And then we also, of course, talked about the current state of bodybuilding. And we talked about the judging and had a really interesting conversation coming up with Bob Ciccarillo. I can't believe I've never had him on the show before. We've had Sean Ray on many times, but we've never had Bob on. So we're kind of continuing our discussion of the Mr. Olympia, which is coming up in only a couple more weeks, three more weeks, on October 11th and 12th in Las Vegas. This will be the 60th Mr. Olympia, so it should be a really big event. They're going to bring a lot of the former Mr. Olympias out there. So I will be out there, and I will report to you guys on how it goes, but it should be a really, really good show. Of course, we had Dan Solomon on last week on the show. Dan is the president of the Mr. Olympia, and he is the one who's been putting it together for the last several years, the last 5 or 6 years. So now we got Bob on the show, and we're going to talk more about the Mr. Olympia. I'm not sure who we're going to have on the show next week, but maybe we'll get someone else on the more current scene of the Mr. Olympia for a while until the contest takes place. All right, what else is going on, guys? I'm reading that book, Mr. America, on Mike Mentzer after interviewing Nicholas Kemla on the show a couple weeks ago. Very interesting book. It's a really big book. I think I said originally it was 600 pages. It's actually almost 700 pages, and I am almost done. I'm about on page 520, I think. Very, very well-written book. Nicholas has his own way of writing that's very interesting, and it's much more interesting than your typical bodybuilding biography. In the book, like, it's written more as a novel where Mike Mentzer is like a character, and it's all about Mike Mentzer's life and a lot about the bodybuilding world. Nicholas really did his research. I found very few mistakes, a couple little errors here and there, but pretty much right on the money as far as Mike's life goes and the world of bodybuilding, and goes all the way back to the Bob Hoffman days and when Weider started and, you know, Arnold's career, Dr. Ziegler, who I didn't know Mike knew very well, but he knew him as a youngster when he was still a teenager because it was all in that East Coast area. So it's very, very interesting. And then, of course, Mike's rise to the top in bodybuilding, coming over to live in California, and all of his competitions. So it's really, really good stuff. You guys should really check it out. Even if you're not a big Mike Mentzer fan, I think you'll love it if you love bodybuilding. So I highly recommend it. We did get a letter, which is about Mike Mentzer. It says, "Hey, John, first, I want to thank you for reading out my last email. Ironically enough, I had mentioned being a fan of Mike Mentzer and following his training style. And then the interview on that podcast was about the new book, Mr. America, on Mike Mentzer. I thoroughly enjoyed the interview with Nicholas. He had some new insights and stories on Mike that I'd never seen before. I'm looking forward to reading the book. Unfortunately, the English version isn't available in Europe yet, so at least for my searches, so I'll have to wait a little while longer." Yeah, I found it on Amazon, okay. I know it's available in the United States, but maybe it's not available in Europe yet. As you also mentioned in the past, Mike is extremely popular amongst the younger audience, and I guess I fall into that audience. I was born in 1990, and by the time I started going to the gym seriously in 2015 or so, Mike was already dead 15 years. I didn't even know who Mike Mentzer was until about 2018, when a YouTuber I follow, I believe it was Jeff Cavalier from Athlean X, mentioned his workout style, and from there I started reading up on heavy duty, and I bought the books as well as the biographies from John Little. My two cents, the reason Mike is incredibly popular is because he really didn't publish any BS. I've read and tried lots of workout programs, including, of course, Arnold's Encyclopedia, as well as other YouTuber or influencers, and they often recommend two-hour workouts consisting of huge set and rep counts per body part 5 to 6 days per week. For a normal person who works a 9-to-5 job, has family, friends, etc., those workouts take away significantly from your social life, and they also don't add a lot of extra gains versus the lower volume, higher intensity. What a lot of these also don't mention is that they're taking something other than protein shakes and creatine to fuel their workouts, so the normal person won't get the same benefits as Arnold by working out 6 times a week, sometimes twice a day, as he suggested. Another reason Mike is so fascinating is he really came and went in a 4-year period, not competing in the Mr. Olympia after 1980. Most of the other bodybuilders from that era had longer careers before and after, but it feels like Mike was robbed of his prime, considering he retired at 28 and others like Zane Dickerson won Mr. Olympias late into their 30s and early 40s. I also came across a heavy-duty workout Mike did with one of his clients on YouTube. I'm sure you've already seen it, but if not, I'll post the links below. It was apparently filmed only a day or two before Mike and his brother Ray passed away, so it's really a glimpse into Mike and Ray's health at the age of 50. From watching the video, they both look a lot older. All the best, John, and looking forward to the next one. Chris from Munich, Germany. All right. Thank you, Chris. And if you guys are interested in seeing this workout video that he posted, I'll include it in the links below if you want to check it out. But I think I've seen that before. And yeah, he's right. Mike and Ray both do a lot. They do look a lot older than 50. They weren't really taking care of themselves back then. So it'll be interesting reading the last part of the book, the last couple hundred pages where Mike's decline happens and how Nicholas talks about that in the book. But I also noticed a really good video today on YouTube from John Little. Maybe I'll post the link for that at the bottom of the description as well. It was about when Mike competed in the 1979 Night of the Champions, where he took third, and he found out right before the contest that his mother was terminally ill and she was dying. And of course, she did die right after that. And then he was not going to compete in the 1979 Mr. Olympia. And then like 3 weeks before the contest, he just all of a sudden got motivated. He started training like a madman and dieting like crazy. And we all know he went into the 1979 Mr. Olympia, probably the best shape of his life. I think he weighed 209 pounds at that contest, got a perfect 300 score in winning the over 200 pound class. And then he just lost the pose down to Frank Zane. That was the best Frank Zane ever looked in 1979. That was Frank's third Mr. Olympia win. Yeah, fascinating life of Mike Mentzer. I've definitely become a little bit more interested. I'm actually going back and looking at all my old muscle builders from the late 70s, early 80s, when Mike was just coming on the scene. It's interesting to look at some of those articles that he wrote and see how his popularity was getting bigger and bigger and bigger year after year. And then it really, I think, peaked in 1978 when he won that Mr. Universe in Acapulco and he got a perfect 300 score. And then he had a great pro year in 1979, this first pro show he won, where he beat Robbie at that Florida show. And then I believe he got second in Pittsburgh, and then he got third at the Night of the Champions. And then, like I said, he had that great Mr. Olympia competition. Yeah, it is funny how, or it's kind of sad, I guess, that his career was so short, because Mike started as a youngster. He was training hard at like 12, 13 years old, but he didn't really compete until he was 19. And he did the Mr. Pennsylvania. I think it was Mr. Pennsylvania. And he won that at 19. And then he got second in Teenage America. And then he went to the Mr. America that Casey won. And he got 10th. And then after that, he hurt his shoulder. And then he was out of competition until 1975. And that's when he went over to the IFBB. I think he got third place at the IFBB America behind Robbie and Roger Callard. And then 1976, he won the Mr. America. And then that was really his rise to fame. So, yeah, I mean, if you look at it, it was really only like 5 years from 75 to 1980 where he was competing again, and he only had that 1 year before that in 1971. So it really was a very short career. So yeah, check out that book if you guys get a chance, and then send me an email. Let me know what you think of it. If you get a chance to get through it, or when you start reading it, let me know what you think of it, and I'll read your responses on the air. All right. So that's all the emails I got. So when we get done with our interview with Bob Ciccariello, I'm going to go to read an old article about Bob. I think this was the first article done about Bob. It was after he won the 87 Junior Nationals in 1987, of course, in Rochester, New York, I think, where Bob grew up. But this comes from the April 1988 issue of Flex Magazine, and it's a profile piece about Bob Ciccariello. So I'm going to read that after we get done with our interview with Mr. Bob Ciccariello. So let's get into that interview right now. And then, like I said, stick around for this article afterwards. All right, here we go. All right, welcome to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have a very special guest with me this week, Mr. Bob Ciccariello, 2000 AAU. I'm sorry, not AAU, the 2000 wow. USA champion.
And this also, is old school.
Yeah. <It's> also known as the voice of bodybuilding. Welcome to the show, Bob. I can't believe we haven't had you on yet.
No, I know. It's about time, you know, but that's okay. Good things come to those who wait. And right. And AAU would actually be appropriate, John, as I actually started my career in the AAU way back in the day because there was no NPC.
Right, right. Actually, that's what I wanted to start off talking to you about, Bob, because I know you started as a teenage competitor like I did, and the teenage yeah. shows back then were huge. So what year did you start? What year did you start training?
I started in beginning of junior high, so the 1977, right okay. when Pumping Iron came out and the yeah. Hulk was out, and you know, all that good stuff. And I was a big avid comic book collector, big into superheroes and all that. So the timing was perfect. I started in 77, 78, and then by mm-hmm. 79, at the ripe old age of 13, I stepped on stage for my first time.
Wow, 13. No kidding. And you were training at Jim Rockel's gym, right, in Rochester?
Well, I started at home. I mean, I had my yeah. own basement gym, and I had gotten a set of weights for Christmas, you know, the old plastic and cement interlocking yeah. Weights. You know, I got the whole kit. You know, it had like the big spring thing that came with it and the hand grippers.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And then you could change the dumbbells, but you had to use that little wrench. Right. So every time you wanted to change a dumbbell weight, you had to take them apart and right. put them back together.
Yeah.
But hey, you know what? It was enough to start, got me going. Then I actually made some of my own equipment at the house, and then finally wow. convinced my parents to take me down to Samson's gym in Rochester because that was the place to be, you know. So, yeah. Yeah. And then from that point on, that was my spot.
Yep. Wow. Yeah. I remember those dumbbells with the screw and stuff. You know, I used to always strip it. I used to always go the wrong way and I'd end up stripping the.
Well, yeah. I mean, listen, they were archaic by today's standard, but that's what you had. I mean, that's all
yeah.
we had.
Yeah. So, what was the name of the first show you did, Bob?
Geez, it was like a local neighborhood show, kind of. I had actually gone to some shows, like the Mr. Rochester and those big shows, Mr. New York State, in my area, mm-hmm. Before I had ever stepped on stage because I like bodybuilding. The first competition was like the Mr. Danglish Village or you know something. It was like the area that we were in.
Okay,
and I actually got my first taste of politics at my very first show as I won like three or four body parts, but I actually lost a show. So the judges were like people's parents they picked out that were like in the competition really? There at the yeah, it was a very small, like I say, it wasn't sanctioned. It wasn't even AAU. It was just literally a local competition wow. that somebody had put together. So, okay. But you know, listen, I was 13. I just started. I got my, got wet my whistle, you know, got my taste for the stage going. Yeah. And like I say, after that, the rest was history. You know, I competed multiple times as a teenager from 13 to 20, obviously, and then wow. moved on from there.
Yeah. Yeah, I did 10 shows myself. I started at 16, and I think I was doing like three or four shows a year for 3 years. So I was almost doing like every teenage show in Chicago, you know.
Well, it was easy to do shows back then, at least for me, because, you know, and I'm sure you can attest. I mean, I was obviously natural as a teenager. Mm-hmm. We didn't diet. You know, my idea was to get bigger, not smaller. So dieting had no, you know, place in my training regimen. I'm going to get yeah. big. There was no cardio back then. That wasn't no. really in style until the 80s.
Right.
So just you trained And if a show came along, you know, you shave down, you put some color on at that point. This is before even the days of Protean. You remember the days of Dioderm,
you had to paint it on.
And they had all these weird sudden tan, right?
Yeah.
These things were terrible, terrible color until Protean came around in the, you know, 87 or so, somewhere around there. But, and so you could go in 3, 4, 5, just depending on whatever was in your area.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did. I mean, so, but it's funny. You mentioned 10. I think I had 10 shows in by the time I was 15.
Wow. No kidding. Damn. Yeah. I know you started young because I started at 16. And I remember reading before you started at like 13 or 14. That's great.
Yeah.
So did you see the movie Pumping Iron in the theater, Bob? Because you, when you started in 77, it was around in the theater back then.
No, it was on TV. I mean, you know, going to the theater was something back then. Yeah. But you would have been going with the family. You know, to see whatever, you know, the Star Wars or, you know, that was out 77, you know, or Jaws or something or something big, you know what I mean? But, you know, there's Pumping Iron was such a small release back then.
Yeah. It was.
The chances are great. It probably wasn't even in my area. This was not a, you know, a huge movie as it came out. It became a cult classic after years. Mm-hmm. And when it caught on because of Arnold, of course, and all that.
Yeah.
So, no, I suspect I saw it on TV, and that just fueled my fire even more because I was already into bodybuilding, and then I saw that. And that just became the gospel of all bodybuilding movies. Still is today.
Yeah, I actually saw it in the theater. I had my parents take me and my brother downtown Chicago. It was playing at some art house theater. Like you said, it was like a it wasn't a wide release at all, you know. So I think it was only there for like maybe 2 weeks. And I went and saw it in the theater. It was like half full, you know, so it was like no big deal then. But it was getting good reviews. The critics were getting a good review. So there was a little bit of people that showed up, you know.
Well, it literally put bodybuilding on the map. Between that and Arnold, bodybuilding went leaps and bounds to that point. You know, it was pretty much relegated to very few real fans and people that were interested. It was still known, unknown as a sport. Arts, you know, I mean, you know, it's debated to this day. And listen, I had to go through the rumor mill and the wives' tales and stuff as a young kid because parents didn't know anything about bodybuilding. It was a weird, odd thing that you wanted to get into. And I was into sports, so I played every sport, you know, which they could relate to: football, baseball, track, bowling.
Okay,
you name it, I played it, you know, as a kid. So, you know, this was just kind of an oddity that they didn't know. I mean, there was things back then. You'll remember, like, you know, you got to be careful. It'll stunt your growth, you know, things like that. You know, of course, there was the whole gay thing. It's, you know, it's gay guys. And this, and it was just a lot of weird, you know, people just didn't get it. They didn't understand it.
No, there were so many old wives' tales. I used to bring the magazines to school when I was in eighth grade. And even the teachers would warn me, like, you don't want to do that. You know, you get muscle bound. And,
right.
They said the big one was all the muscle would turn to fat when you get older.
All that. Yeah. I always like muscle bound, you know, it's muscle bound, like you're in search of muscle. I am muscle bound, you know, but this idea that back then, but that's what the way it was in the late 70s, early 80s was the idea that if you got too muscular, that you couldn't move, that, you know, it's going to impair your athletic ability. Yeah. It wasn't until decades later that really that would come into play in other sport. People in sports knew about weight training. People out of sports and even coaches had no clue.
No. Yeah, I think my football coach at the high school wouldn't even let the guys lift weights, I think. Yeah, they weren't even doing that back then.
No, they had like that off-season program. You know, you could lift some weights like on the Universal. It was written, you know, back in the 60s probably by somebody. But it was – I had more knowledge in high school than any of my coaches about bodybuilding, weight training, weight lifting. They knew nothing about any of that stuff.
Yeah. So when did you and Sean meet? Because I think you guys are the same age, right? Did you meet in a teenage show?
We are. Actually, Sean's birthday is this week coming up. So happy birthday to my slightly older brother. He will venture into 59, bro, as I still hang back at 58. My birthday's in December. So me and Sean actually met at the Teenage National Championships. We were competing against each other.
Okay.
And that's where we had met. Keep in mind, there's no internet back then. There's magazines.
Yeah.
Obviously, we didn't know each other or even of each other. And that's where we met. We got chatting there, got talking. And we've had a friendship literally ever since. I mean, we go back. I actually go back with Sean about the longest as anybody in the business, with the exception of possibly a JM and Jim Mannion, because I met them at probably around 15 when I was just a young guy as my chairman, who was Jim Rockell at the time, was getting involved in the judging and things like that. So he became, we shifted like from the AAU at the time, which was the only game in town, to this new thing called the NPC. Mm-hmm. And we went wherever Jim was going to go. I mean, we didn't know anything about federations and things. And
yeah,
and that's how it became a thing. But I remember back then meeting JM. He's 3 years older than me, I think. So at the time, I'm, 15. He's 17, 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So, we all go back. And I remember meeting Jim Mannion at the time, who was a young man who was making his way across America in a car or a truck, whatever he had. And that's how you did it back then. He literally built the NPC, going from town to town, state to state, gym to gym, and recruiting people, judges, chairmen, people who wanted to get involved, promoters.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we built it back then.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember that time because all the teenage shows I did was all AAU. And then I think it switched over, like you said, like in 82. And I think that was my last year I was competing as a teenager. So then I remember Illinois. I lived in Chicago, so Illinois was kind of slow making the change. They were kind of AAU strong for a while, and then they finally went over to the NPC.
Yeah, there were certain pockets that were still kind of AAU, and then other pockets that quickly turned to NPC. NPC had a distinct advantage back then because it was direct pipeline. Smartest move Jim ever made was attaching himself as the sister organization to the IFBB.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to get to the big leagues, the pros, Weeder, all that stuff, right? Mr. Olympia, we had to go through, the stepping stone of the NPC to the Nationals, to the U.S., that type of thing, to the World Championships. And eventually, hopefully, you got to the pros. So great move on Jim's part, because that's what separated all the talent, literally been within 2 years.
Yes. Yeah.
All the good talent from AAU went to the NPC if they weren't there already. And by 87, the rest of any good talent came over. 87 Nationals, we had an influx of AAU guys like Joe Mico, James DeMello, Phil Hill.
Glenn Kinnear.
There were some great bodybuilders who came over. Glenn Kinnear.
Yeah.
These are names only you would know, John. That's why I like talking to you about these things.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember if you look at the AAU America and the NPC Nationals, like 82, 83, you could see every year the numbers were starting to shift more toward the Nationals, and you were seeing, the greater town, like you said, was going toward the NPC, because everybody realized if you want to be a pro and you want to compete in the Olympia, you got to go through the NPC.
Well, the AAU was kind of a road to nowhere at that point. They kind of gave up the ship. Like, they really weren't interested in bodybuilding anymore. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how the NPC was spawned. Everybody thinks Jim started this as a rival organization. That's actually untrue. Jim was a part of the AAU. And the bodybuilding division, because the AAU was mostly weightlifting. You're talking about the old Bob Hoffman days, York Barbell. And the AAU was the sanctioning body for a lot of different athletic events, Amateur Athletic Union, AAU.
Mm-hmm.
So bodybuilding, they really didn't seem to have any interest in for some odd reason. And they kind of let Jim take that. And, hey, listen, if you want to do this, go over here, start this NPC thing. And it kind of divided at that point. It was only after the fact that they kind of, I think they regretted that move quickly, because it was such a mass exodus. And then they got into a big legal dispute over the names.
Yeah.
So for those who want a quick history lesson, the National Championships was the Mr. America. The Mr. USA was now turned into the USA Bodybuilding Championships, and so on and so on. They wanted the rights to the Mr. titles.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the NPC fought them in court. NPC actually lost because the AAU was around forever.
Mm-hmm.
And they got to retain the Mr. titles. That's why technically, even though like today, like, we'll refer to things as Mr. because they're long gone.
Yeah.
Technically speaking, there is no Mr. title other than the Mr. Olympia in the NPC / IFBB Pro League.
Yeah. Yeah. I just read a book about a year ago about Bob Hoffman, and he was all about the Olympic weightlifting and power, not even powerlifting, more the Olympic weightlifting. He wanted to
Olympic, create
the greatest American team, for Olympic weightlifting, but he really didn't care about bodybuilding at all. But I think the bodybuilders, you know, the bodybuilding contest and the bodybuilders was what was attracting the crowds. Because nobody, you would get really small crowds for these weightlifting events, but he knew if he put a bodybuilding show at the end of it, that's when you would get the people to come in, you know.
Well, the funny part is, and again, this is predating even you and I into the realm of teenage area. In the 70s, they would have powerlifting events, Olympic weightlifting, powerlifting, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And the halftime entertainment was a bodybuilding show. Mm-hmm. So like Gary Yuta tells a story and Jim Mannion of them, you know, putting a light bulb over the basketball hoop, right, and hanging it down, and they would put up a podium and they would have a bodybuilding show. And you're right. What happened was, is there a big shift happened where people found that more interesting than the weightlifting, which is not the most exciting thing you've ever seen. If you ever, you know, you got to really be into that to be into that.
Yeah.
And that's when it shifted over, and bodybuilding, you know, all of a sudden, before you knew it, it was bodybuilding shows having weightlifting stuff as the halftime entertainment. So that's where bodybuilding kind of got its start. And then, you know, literally went on from there.
Yeah. I did an interview with Boyer Coe, and he said he was in the, I think it might've been Teenage Mr. America or Junior Mr. America. And he said, they literally went until 1 o'clock in the morning until they started the pre-judging, you know?
Well, you know, what's funny is I remember, and again, when we started, there was only men's bodybuilding.
Yes.
If there was a women's show, it was, they only had like the Miss Bikini Body Beautiful competition type of thing. It wasn't like what we know now as any type of women's bodybuilding. That didn't start until the late 70s. But I remember them having like these bikini shows, and it was just kind of a, you know, Body Beautiful competition. Like I said, that's what it was. Yeah. And they had those going all the way back into the 70s. I remember those shows going till 12, 1 in the morning. And all we had was men's bodybuilders, but they used to pad those shows up something fierce with reading bios on stage. I remember having to fill out, you know, the bio on the sheet where you listed all your titles, where you trained, where you went to school.
Right.
You know, and they would read every word, you know, and every guy would pose. And
that's funny, yeah.
You know, interestingly, that's where when I started, and again, this I'd love to get your take on this if you had the same experience. When I started, you actually had to make the night show. There was no guarantee. If you did, the prejudging was just that. They used to get rid of people, even despite not being huge numbers like we have today. But if they didn't deem you good enough at the prejudging, they gave you a ticket and said, hey, man, enjoy the show. And you had to make the night show, that the finals. That's what the finals was for.
Oh, wow.
Was for the finals.
Yeah.
I didn't know if any of your shows were like that when you started, but they were when I started.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I remember that. I remember I did the Teenage Mr. Illinois like three times, and that show was crazy because they used to always have height classes, short class,
yeah,
medium class, tall class. The Teenage Illinois did something smart where they did it in age groups. Because, you know, when you're 16 or 17, it's hard to compete with the guy who's 19. So they would put the 19-year-old guys by themselves. They put the 17 and 18-year-old guys in their class. And then the 14 to 16-year-olds were in their class. The first one I did, they had 89 competitors. The next year, they had 100 competitors. So in my class, there was 40 guys in the class. It was like a national-level NPC show. It was crazy.
That's huge.
Yeah, I tell people that today, and you know, the teenage shows are non-existent today. People can't believe that, but it was like
ours were tall and short, so they didn't do the age thing. So I competed, I was just in the tall class, and that was it. You competed against the short guy winner for the title, and that was the end of that. Did you beat Chuck Sanow? That's my question.
Me and Chuck, never really competed against each other. I started right before Chuck, and I think he was a year older than me. So then when he competed in the teenage show, he was in a different class. And then we finally competed when we were in our 20s. They had a show called the Chicago Challenge. And it was a pretty cool show. It was like a one-time only show. It was invitation. And they invited like the top 15 guys from the Midwest area, guys who had won like Mr. Illinois, Mr. Midwest.
Sure.
And they ran it like an IFBB pro show. So they had a symmetry round, they had a compulsory round, and then they did the free posing, and they judged every round. And Chuck was a week out from the junior nationals. He was always shredded. So he won. And I think I got third or fourth. So yeah, Chuck was a good competitor.
Very cool.
Well, Bob, I wanted to have you on to talk about the Mr. Olympia, because we got the 60th Mr. Olympia coming up this year. Of course, you'll be the MC. What was the first Mr. Olympia you ever saw?
It's funny because as much as I'm a historian of sport, I can't remember the first Olympia I saw. It was back some time ago. I'm going to say it wasn't that early. Like, I had no means to go to these shows. You know, I didn't have any money. I was a kid, you know, the whole thing. parents weren't didn't really support, you know, that they weren't against it, but I mean, I couldn't have gone and asked for, hey Dad, can I have $100 so I can, you know, get in the car with my boys and go watch the Olympia.
Right.
So I remember seeing an Arnold before the Olympia, but all that kind of stuff for me didn't happen until late 80s, I believe, was like the first one or two of those, because I remember going to the Night of the Champions in 89.
Yeah, right.
That's
in New York.
When Danny Padilla was kind of making a comeback and he was going to go in the show. And I had just taken a second place at the USA. So that was my first taste of getting some notoriety, because I had gone to New York City. Because that was close, being from New York, you know, it was only from upstate, it's only, you know, 5-6 hours from there. So we went to the show, and I was amazed that so many people knew who I was.
Yeah.
Because by that point, I had won the 87 Junior Nationals.
Right.
Made my debut at the Nationals, taking a top five that same year. And then 88, you know, took a third, was in the couples USA. I was in a couple other things. But I had made some covers by that point. I was in the first ever edition of the NBC News. I was in the Muscular Development cover. Okay. I had started to get a little bit of fame, but again, back then there is no internet. So you don't really get a lot other, you know, you got some letters or you got some fan mail type of a thing, if anybody could even track you down. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until I got to New York that I was shocked at how many people knew who I was, would come up, want to take pictures, want to, you know, talk to you.
Yeah.
You know, because by that point, like, as I had literally just taken second place in the USA to Johnny Moran.
Yeah.
And just missed my chance of getting a pro card. You know, it would turn out to be some 11 years before I would actually end up getting it. But
that's a whole
other story for a whole other podcast. But that was cool because it was the NOC. And man, there were some, I remember being shocked. One of the things that shocked me the most was I couldn't believe how big Bob Paris was.
Mm.
I never knew, again, now all we had was magazines to go by.
Right.
And Bob Paris had that beautiful, you know, physique, but he was on the slim side comparatively to some of the big boys, you know, the big dogs. So I just never assumed that he was that big. And then I run into him in person, and he's taller than I am. And his calves were huge. I remember he had a pair of shorts on. His calves were huge. I'm like, holy crap. Like, I didn't know he was that big.
Right.
So. By contrast, there were some guys that I didn't know were that small. I mean, there were some people that I had, you know, looked at for years in the magazines. I just assumed were about my height or so. And I'd run into them and they were five, you know, like Boyer and those guys and Tom Platz. And they're 5'5", 5'6", maybe.
Yeah, exactly right. You mentioned the Junior Nationals. So you won that in 87. How old were you then, Bob? Like 20, 21?
21, yeah. Just turned 21. Wow. And that was coming off of the year before in Niagara Falls, where I got my ass handed to me. Didn't make the cut.
No kidding.
Let me tell you something. That was humbling and sobering, because I had come off of an incredible teenage career, you know, where I was just cleaning house. And you know, I won almost every show I went in. Not every show, but most of them. Took second at the, you know, the Teenage Nationals, you know, that whole thing.
Yeah.
This goddamn guy named Sean Ray won. And and then, you know, I go to the juniors and listen, I'm ready to keep kicking ass, you know. So I venture into the men's division, you know, the open, and I didn't make the top 15.
Wow.
And I didn't make any excuses. I looked at the pictures. I said, you know what? I need more muscle on this frame. I need to, you know, and I took the next year, put my nose in a grindstone, didn't say a word to nobody about nothing. And I came back in 87 and won the supers and then the overall. So,
wow. So you went from not making the top 15 to winning the overall in 1 year.
Well, I knew I had what it took, but I looked like a young amateur body. You know, I needed thickness, front to back in particular, because I was tall and I got, you know, decent sized arms and legs in terms of length. So it took a while to, and I was natural.
Yeah.
I took nothing. I mean, not only no steroids or any anabolics, but I didn't even take supplements. I mean, I'm
really wow.
By that time, I was actually dieting. You know, like I knew enough to, okay, you got to get in shape. You know, it wasn't like the old teenage days, but I took no supplements or anything like that. You know, and it's like, well, I better make a decision there, buddy, or you know, it ain't gonna. I don't think this is gonna go too far.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you if you were in that Niagara Falls. I was in that show too. I did the heavyweights. I made. I was third call out, so I guess I was somewhere between 11th and 15th. But
you did better than me.
Yeah. My brother took some pictures. I was looking for you in the background because I knew you had to be in it because it was in Niagara Falls, and it's close to your house.
Funny part is you wouldn't have caught me in there because I think I was in the light heavyweights, believe it or not.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, so I wasn't heavy in terms of dense muscle.
Yeah.
I was tall and I was broad, but I was like a 2x4. You know what I mean? Where it was, you know,
okay.
if you're standing, but, you know, you go to the side and it's like, oh, this guy needs a little mature. You know, I needed to mature. My physique needed to mature.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I wasn't, you know, I went from whatever that cutoff was, you know, 198 and a quarter to, I think I was around 217 the following year, you know, and, you know, so I put on some good muscle and you know, the waist was small and all that, and, you know, went on from there. But my first Olympia was until years later, as you, I know you asked originally, but that I went to, and I can't remember the exact year, but all I know is like, that was it for me. Like, I got to get to the promised land.
Yeah.
You know, I got to get that pro card. I got to get the, the Venice Beach, you know, and all that stuff.
Yeah. So you were in the light heavies against Sean and Eddie Robinson.
Yeah. Well, wow. yes and no. I wasn't really against them. You know, I mean, I was in the same class. Let's put it that way.
Right. Yeah. I was like 5'8", around 201. And I remember I went in it and I went in as a heavyweight. And my brother asked me, he goes, why did you go in as a heavyweight? You could have lost like 3 pounds and went as a light heavyweight. I go, well, there's two guys in the light heavyweight I don't want to go up against. And then when my brother saw him, he goes, yeah, you're right. You want to beat those guys.
Yeah, that wasn't the worst thinking. But, you know, it's funny. You mentioned the 60th Olympia, and we also mentioned that it was Sean's birthday. We're the same age.
Yeah.
Interestingly, we're still trying to figure out the parameters of the math equations. But the 60th Olympia, yet we're turning 59. So it's take your pick as to –
Right.
You know, if it's annual, if it's in consecutive, I know there's no year zero and all that stuff, but
yeah,
we're still trying to figure that whole thing out, you know.
Hey, you guys were born in 65, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That was the first Olympia. So, but I guess year one is a year later. So I guess that's why you're a year behind.
That's where it gets weird. Yeah. Because you're like, well, wait a minute. How is this the 60th Olympia? But you guys are only 59, but you're the same age. And, you know, it's, So,
one thing I want to talk to you about was, you know how they used to have what we call the incumbency factor with Mr. Olympia, where a guy would win it and he would keep winning it. I guess it started with Arnold because Arnold won it 6 times in a row. And then Lee Haney won it 8 times in a row. And then Dorian and then Ronnie.
Right.
So now it seems like they don't have that anymore. Now we're seeing different winners all the time, and which I think is a lot more exciting because now you never know who's going to win. Where before it was kind of like you got to knock the champ out, like they used to say, or the guy would have to quit before somebody new would come along. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, back in the day, it's literally a matter of just one of those people coming along. And one of those people only come along every here and there.
Yeah.
That guy was Arnold, you know, back in the day, 7 Olympias, we know. That guy was Lee Haney. Mm-hmm. That guy was Dorian Yates. That guy was Ronnie Coleman. That guy was Phil Heath.
Yeah.
And those are the guys, obviously, the most winning, you know, Mr. Olympias of all time. They don't come around every once in a while. And right now we're in one of those gap years where it might go 2 or 3 years, kind of like the, you know, Frank Zane to, the Franco to Samir to Chris Dickerson. You know, there was like that little transition time, before, boom, here's Lee Haney, ladies and gentlemen. There goes 8 years. But that said, it's very difficult to take out an incumbent champ in bodybuilding because that one person comes along who's a little something special, and that kind of becomes the look, and then everybody starts chasing that look. And that's not usually good for other people. It plays right into the champ's hands, kind of like when Lee Haney came around, you know, and everybody started to try to bump their game up. Nobody did more disservice to everybody else than Dorian. Mm-hmm. Because when Dorian stepped through that portal, he messed up more people's physiques than anybody by not doing anything but except being the champ. Because now you're seeing guys going, holy crap. So now I got to put on 15 pounds of muscle and be grainy. You know, this new term grainy that all of a sudden, you know, came out. You never heard that one before.
Right.
And again, he made guys up their game, but that his game isn't your game. And that's where he ended up beating people at their own game because, well, he's not playing the game. He's just being Dorian Yates.
Yeah.
Just got all choked up just thinking about that, bro. you know, and he was like, look, I'll be over here doing what I'm doing in the dungeon. over in England, and you guys can chase me. And we watched Fedorov and JP Fuchs and all those guys, even the top guys, all tried coming in bigger, and it would distort their physiques, and he would win again, even against some better competition sometimes. Because even though I'm not, I always respected Dorian, but I don't have him winning six titles. I just don't.
Yeah, me neither. Yeah.
But then again, I always tend to go towards the more symmetrical guys, the Flex Wheelers, the Kevin Lavronis, the Sean Rays.
Yeah.
Listen, the first 3 years or so, Dorian, nobody was touching him.
Right.
Nobody. He was so far ahead of the pack.
Yeah.
Again, the last guy, Phil Heath, winning seven, arguably could have won eight or even nine in my book. But seven is what he's got, puts him with Arnold, and he's very elite company. We haven't seen that next guy yet.
Yeah.
So to your point, right now, yeah, we are in transition, and now you've got, we had Brandon Curry, then you had Big Ramy, then you had Hadi Choopan, then now you've got you had Sean Roden in there.
Yeah.
You've got, now you've got Derek Lunsford. So we're in
Yeah.
that transition, but none of those guys, with all due respect, do I see, even the younger guys, Derek Lunsfords and some of these, I don't see anybody there putting together five, six, seven, eight Olympians. I just don't see it yet.
Yeah, I don't either, because the competition is so tough now, and it's like everybody is making so many improvements every year. I mean, I'm looking at the guys now going in it this year, and they're putting in their update photos or their videos on, Instagram and stuff, and I'm like, wow. I mean, I just saw Hunter Labrada, and I'm seeing Derek, and it's like these guys have taken it up such a another notch from last year alone. I can't imagine somebody coming in winning
The guy
six
who
or
might
eight.
fill those shoes right now, John, is probably either A, isn't even training as a bodybuilder, B, might even be in another sport, or is yet to emerge. And listen, quite frankly, the talent pool isn't what we used to be either. I mean, I'm going to keep things very real, as we do. It's old school guys. We catch grief for it, but I don't make no apologies for it, John. The bodybuilding today is not as deep as it was 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and certainly not 20 years ago. It just isn't. So I don't think we have, again, the talent pool's a little diluted. I don't think, again, we have the best that could be up there. Listen, Phil Heath came from a different sport. He was a basketball player. I mean, there you go, right? I mean, your next Mr. Olympia, multi-time champ, should there be one in our lifetime? That's debatable. He might be playing something else right now. He may be coming off a different sport. Or like I say, maybe he hasn't even started training yet. I don't know. But I think we'll be old men waxing on the old days if that comes around.
Yeah, the late Peter McGuff, I remember he said once, he said the next Ronnie Coleman might be a guy that we don't even predict coming up right now. He might not even be one of the top guys right now. He might just come out of nowhere, and that might be the guy that's going to win six or eight next Mr. Olympias,
Well, listen, it's hard to put all those things. There's one Ronnie Coleman. There's one. I mean, when you talk about dominant, right? I mean, there's one Lee Haney, right? There was one Arnold. These guys have a combination and a mix of a whole bunch of things that has to be perfect. Even Flex Wheeler, right? As great as he was, as great as that physique was, the only Achilles heel he had was he couldn't get that crazy conditioning like the other guys could. Not with maintaining that size. He could go down and he could get it, but then he would be a little thinner, right? And it wouldn't work in his favor. Or he could go up and he's thick as a brick, but then again, he was lacking in the detail. Again, Phil Heath, the last guy who was able to put all those factors together, the posing, the display, the muscularity, the level of conditioning, the level of separation, and able to stay healthy, six, seven, eight, 9 years. I don't care what division you're in. An Iris Kyle at 10 is incredible. A Sydney Gillen at seven, probably going to eight, is incredible. The fact that you can stay focused and healthy for the better part of a decade is nothing short of incredible.
It is, yeah. And the mindset you got to have to come back every year and have that hunger and stay confident and believe you can do it again. I mean, that's in itself something amazing, because you have the genetics, the work ethic, one thing, the workouts, but to have that mindset and not screw up, that's amazing. I talked to Sean last time we were on here. We were talking about the 93 Olympia, and we were talking about how they used to have the different rounds of judging. They used to have a round for symmetry, and they would judge that, and a round for the compulsory poses, and then a round for the posing. And they would judge all three rounds. And do you think bodybuilding would be better now, the Mr. Olympia would be better if they had those rounds again, or do you like the way it is now?
The problem, I go back and forth on this because I do think there's probably a better system that we could be using. And we've tried various ones. Again, people like us who are historians now, they've had five, six, seven different types of judging rounds, procedures, things that they've changed over the years. They're assessing your physique all the time. So I can argue both sides and go, well, look, you may not be getting judged for it, but you are absolutely, or you may not be getting a score for it, but you're absolutely getting judged on it. Okay, there's a difference there. Just like the problem I have is like if you're assessing symmetry, okay, it's not true symmetry because this is symmetrical. This is a pen that I'm holding, if anybody can't see that, right? Perfectly symmetrical, right? But void of any detail of muscle of this. So when if you could the best guy with the best symmetry could be the 15th place guy in the show, if that's what you're purely assessing, right? So it's never pure. It's never a pure symmetry round. It's never a pure muscularity round. It's never a pure posing round. As I've debated, for 15 years with Milos on the posing, it's very difficult to assess. You have to do it from a bodybuilding standpoint. Bodybuilding symmetry and regular symmetry is two different things. Again, this can is perfectly symmetrical. It's a can of Celsius, by the way, John. Little shout out there. But again, it's perfectly symmetrical, right? But it's a can. I mean, it's the same size. There's no V taper. There's no leg sweep, right? There's no nothing. So you're talking about bodybuilding sense of symmetry. So okay, you could judge that, and I wouldn't have any issue if we did judge it like that. But it can't be void of everything else. So it's really kind of everything's a muscularity round with a splash of symmetry, with a splash of posing, with a splash of whatever. So that's where it gets difficult. It's like, okay, well, which system is better than another? I wouldn't mind seeing a more visual standpoint in terms of like the judging process. Like, does anybody get deducted points? Like, I actually wouldn't mind seeing a system where you actually see deductions. It's like, well, look at you. You were fourth in the symmetry round because, you didn't have as much V taper as this guy, that type of thing. And I think that would be easier to explain to people, not just the fans, but the athletes, why you placed where you did or why you didn't place where you didn't place. So it gets very muddled and very difficult. I can argue with myself on it as to what's the better process of judging. But I wouldn't mind seeing more boxes being checked. Because you come out for symmetry and you kind of get assessed, but again, that would throw off the judging. I used to argue this again with the posing round. The guy with the best posing routine, he could be dead last in the show. It's like, well, wait a minute. If that were to happen and you were to score it accordingly, the guy who should have been in dead last, he might be in fifth. And you go, well, wait a minute. He doesn't have the fifth best physique. It's like, well, yeah, but he won the posing round. And now it throws off the whole thing. It's like at the end of the day, we're looking for the guy with the best physique on stage, the best, most muscular physique. Keeping the ideals of the early bodybuilding days, the Steve Reeves-esque style, symmetry,
Symmetry,
proportion,
proportion, right?
size, muscularity, definition,
Right.
the posing or the art of display, whatever you want to call that, right? All of those factors should be rounded into one. The biggest freak rarely ever wins a show. And that's for good reason, right? Because it's like, well, wait a minute, there's more to it than just muscle. It can't be muscle void of symmetry or muscle void of display or muscle void of shape or proportion. And this is where it gets difficult. And again, we all saw the New York Pro earlier in the year where Nick Walker goes up against Martin Fitzwater. And listen, a lot of people, including myself, had Martin Fitzwater winning because I thought he checked more of the boxes. And I know Tyler came out and he explained to everybody what the judges saw and what they thought. What he didn't explain, though, is they kind of glossed past the symmetry, proportion, shape, that type of. It's like, well, wait a minute. If I just take those three factors right there, Martin Fitzwater's ahead 3-0. I don't think anybody would argue that Martin had better symmetry, proportion, or shape. But those things kind of get put into one group and shoved off to the side, and then we go for the muscle. And it's like, well, but that's not tr traditional bodybuilding checking all the boxes. So that's, if I were to put a proposal in for that, it would be to kind of like more the old school, John. Again, check more boxes.
I agree. Because when I hear these prediction shows on a lot of these other podcasts, they only go by the seven mandatory poses. And if they're looking at a contest that just took place last weekend, they're going, well, he won four to three poses, or he won right. 5-2. But like, it's a scoring contest. But I go, it's not really a scoring contest. There's more to it. Like you said, there's more to it than that. There's symmetry, proportion, and the physique looks different correct. When it's relaxed than when it's posing. You know, you can look at different aspects of a physique.
Absolutely.
You can look at the proportion. You can look at the symmetry. So I think, like, if we're looking at today's bodybuilder, someone like Andrew Jack, I think would score higher in a symmetry round than probably sure. someone like Derek, because he's taller, he's got the wide shoulders, he's got the small waist, he looks amazing just standing relaxed.
This is where it gets odd in this game is, again, just using that same example. So you got Nick and you got Martin, okay? And these guys were very close. So depending, I don't care who you liked, if you like Nick or if you like Martin. It literally, and even to the judges, they said, could have gone either way, right? It was that close. It could have gone either way. Here's the problem, right? We're all doing our prediction shows, right, John? We all got podcasts, right? Other people's podcasts. There's not one person that I've heard so far, not an expert, not a fan, not a podcast expert, you know, again, these guys, not one of them has had Martin Fitzwater in the same conversation as Nick Walker. Now, arguably, this is a guy who could have beaten Nick Walker.
Yeah, he was only like a
again,
point.
Again, that's by most of the people that were there. Again, whether you picked one side or the other, it was possible, right? It wasn't like it was a blowout. It was that close.
Yeah.
But you haven't seen, or again, correct me if I'm wrong, John, I haven't seen not one panel of anybody given their predictions of the first call out or whatever, that had Nick Walker in there, but they didn't have Martin Fitzwater.
Right. Yeah. They got Martin.
It's like, well, wait a minute. What happened at the Olympia here all of a sudden that this guy's not even in consideration when arguably he could have beat him?
Yeah. 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 And I think the same could be said about the posing. You know, I'm old school like yourself, and I believe, you know, the posing is important. How you display your physique. I mean, it is an art show when we get to the contest, right? Because I think, you know, bodybuilding, look at it like the athlete part is the preparation for the show. And then the actual show itself isn't really, you're really not really an athlete on stage as far as having the endurance to do the posing. But as far as displaying your physique, that's where you're the artist. And the ones who do that correctly, you know, like Sean Ray could do that. And, you know, Ed Corney, Lee Labrada, Mohamed Makawe, those guys should be rewarded or given more points or placed higher because of their ability to display their physique. Now, I know what you're saying about you could have a guy who's got a last place physique and he's not going to place first in the posing, but he should place maybe a higher. I remember I was looking at the scoring sheets from, I think, the 77 Olympia, and Ed Corney placed higher than Boyer Coe in the third round, you know, in the posing round. He didn't beat Frank Zane. Sure. No, I think he actually might have beat Frank Zane in that one round. He actually ended up in third place. Zane won, but he did get rewarded for that. But he was a top physique. You know, he ended up in third place. He wasn't like an eighth place physique. So
the problem I always had with the poser, and this is why we got rid of it years ago. People still ask, why did they get rid of scoring it? And I actually proposed that we get rid of it. I was the one who did that. And it's for good reason, because they used it as a makeup round. Nobody in modern bodybuilding, forget about even the 70s and the 80s, let's just go modern bodybuilding, okay? Nobody ever won the posing round. Like for instance, let me put it this way. Arguably, Sean Ray could have beaten Dorian Yates in 90, what was it, 94, I think?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
93, 94, whatever that 94. Year was, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 94, okay? Guess who won the posing round?
Dorian
Yates. Now, do I need a better example in the history of mankind when it comes to bodybuilding, right?
Right.
As to what a bullshit round that was, that nobody, whoever placed, wherever they placed, Sean took, you know who took second in the posing round? Sean Ray, who took second in the show.
Yeah.
There were shows that if you took fourth, you took fourth in the posing round. You took fifth. It was just a makeup round, really. It was just another muscularity round. So they weren't judging. And what are you judging? Are you judging the physiques? Are you judging the actual posing? Are you judging the music? You know, I've always used the example. It's like, it's impossible to do. You can't compare Frank Sinatra to 50 Cent. Okay. it's two different genres. It's two different everything, right? It's like, well, wait a minute. I don't know. Is it an entertaining routine or a pop lock routine like a Darren Charles or a Melvin Anthony?
Yeah.
Listen, you and I have both seen some knockdown. I mean, I've seen some great, you know, King Kamali, my old buddy, right? I mean, doing the robot, Vince Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
These are some of the greatest posers in history. Was Lee Labrada a better poser than Lee Haney? Probably, but he never won the posing round. And this was the problem I had. I was like, look, if you guys are going to, we either have to define it and pose it and score it accordingly or get rid of it.
Yeah.
Now, in lieu of that, I suggested, which happens and doesn't happen, get money for it. If you want to keep the posing routines entertaining or good or traditional or whatever, put 25 grand on it. Okay, I'll guarantee you got some entertaining routines out there. When a guy can put, you know, 20 grand, 25 grand in his pocket by putting a little bit of thought and effort into it. But let's make no mistake, you're not winning Mr. Olympia or losing Mr. Olympia because of your posing routine, nor should you, because we're looking for the best physique. I'm not interested in the best dancer. I'm not interested in the guy who could do a whirlwind great posing routine, but doesn't have as good of a physique. So this is why I opted to, you know, for the Pro League to take a look and get rid of it. And at the end of the day, they agreed with me. And I said, you either score it as is or we get rid of it. But that would mess everything up because, like I said, you know, you've got numerous examples in history at a bodybuilding stage of great posers. Never. Bob Parris never went a posing around.
Yeah.
I can go on and on and on. The greatest posers in the world never won a posing round at the Olympia, not once, not ever. If anybody can show me different, by all means, bring it up.
Well, I like what you just said about maybe defining it. Maybe if they could bring it back and somehow define it to the judges and just say, you know, the whole idea of it is to show the physique to its best advantage. So it's not really a matter of, is it the most entertaining, the pop lock or the, you know, the Vince Taylor type of thing. Right. I mean, if he can show his physique to its greatest advantage by doing that, great. But it's not about who can dance or who can do that. It's about who can, you know, creatively and artistically, I guess, show your physique to the greatest, like Muhammad Mukawi or Labate used to do.
Muhammad Mukawi never won a Best Poser Award, right? I mean, so I can go on and on. But, you know, here's the problem with that, John. And we got to think of things a little bit objectively here. All you're showing is a lesser physique to your best ability. This this brings in mind the now famous or infamous, I should say, challenge round.
Oh, yeah.
Right? The challenge round was really a glorified posing round, right? So you were supposed to be able, and I didn't like this thing from the start. I knew it had disaster written all over it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because literally you were taking guys who had just competed against each other in the prejudging, giving them another opportunity to show their physique at its best, right? Because you get to call out the pose.
Yeah.
Front double bicep, front lat spread. Oh, I'll take side chest against this guy, right?
Yeah.
And the results were exactly the same.
Yeah.
It's like, well, why would the fifth place guy beat the first place guy when he just got his ass handed to him,
yeah,
right? For an hour in the prejudging. So yeah. Again,
that one time when Gustavo beat Ronnie, remember, and Ronnie was all pissed.
Well, and see again, and that was a joke, right?
It's like,
did anybody in that house?
Right.
And I love listening. Gustavo, God bless him, and Ronnie, right? I mean, you know, one of the greatest of all. Is there anybody you could ever find? Any guest you've ever had? Anything you've ever read? That had Gustavo beating Ronnie?
No.
No, right? It wasn't even a, hey, man, you think Gustavo should have beaten Ronnie in that Olympia? No, hell no, right? Well, no. Then how the hell is he beating him in the challenge round?
It's like,
it didn't mean anything. It was a mathematical nightmare. Again, I didn't like it at all from the start.
Yeah.
But it illustrates my point, which is you can illustrate your physique to its best, and that's great. But if it's a lesser physique still, you're still behind this guy. He's got a better physique, and he can display it just fine. Unless you have an inability to show your physique. And I've seen guys, doesn't happen often, but I've seen guys lose shows because they actually literally couldn't pose. Like Dillette was a great example, right?
Yeah,
Paul Dillette, who arguably had some of the best genetics of all time, right? This guy, I mean, it's like, holy crap. But he couldn't control his body. He literally could not show his physique to its best. Gary Striden was another one.
Mm-hmm.
He just absolutely had no control over his back pose. He just could not fan that back out. He couldn't show it. It was a crimped up, you know, shoulder blades together, awkward.
Yeah. Right.
He literally could lose because you could not display a superior physique. Standing there, he was better.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I just I look at today's bodybuilders, and it just doesn't seem like any of them are putting any effort into posing. And it's probably because they know it's not being judged. And I think it would be kind of cool even if you had a guy who was – you know, he could have been second, he was fourth, and he goes to the judges and they go, well, man, you just got to pose better. And then he's going to up his game, and then it's going to, you know, then we're going to have guys trying harder to do a better job at it. I just think, I look at the posing round, and again, I'm old school, I know, but I look at the posing round, I just think it's just such a vast potential of creativity.
Yes.
And who knows what could be developed? And I just don't see anybody even like trying it anymore because it's probably
Well,
not being judged, you know.
if I was restructuring things going forward or a part of that process, I would say again, these guys are professionals. They're looking at the cash, right? You may
Yeah.
not be the best physique, but maybe you got the best post. Put some money on these damn things. Get some money, just like they did this year. Find some sponsors, find some money, bump
Yeah.
these purses up, and let's start spreading the wealth a little bit into things like that.
Yeah.
Where again, you know, you can make a good dollar or, you know, a pretty good dime by being innovative, by doing a good entertaining routine or whatnot.
Yeah.
I'm all for it, but you got to put money on this. Like, that would be the incentive to anybody going on stage. These guys are competing for money. They're competing for titles, but they're also competing for money prizes. So
Yeah. Yeah.
that to me, listen, I can't think of any better incentive for a guy who probably thinks, well, I probably don't have a chance against these top three, but I can outpose these guys all day long. And there's $10,000. Here's
Yeah.
$20,000, you know, more than a guy who's going to play fourth or fifth. So
Yeah.
that would be my suit.
Yeah, as long as the judges would award it to somebody who not necessarily does an entertaining routine, but a great posing routine. You know, I mean, I get nostalgic when I look at someone like Mohamed
I know.
Bakali or Labrada. Or remember Rory Liedemeyer in the 93 National
Sure.
when he got second?
Yeah.
I mean, that routine was so moving. I mean, he got a standing ovation. And he
Bro,
had like
listen,
tears in
bro,
his
I
eyes when
was.
he got done. It was so great, you know.
Listen, I was standing next to Phil Hill when he brought the house down at the damn Nationals.
Oh yeah,
So,
87. Yeah.
you know what I mean? It's like holy crap, like you know. And that was a very traditional, like I say, to you know, an operatic type music, you know, thing. You know, he posed the Phantom of the Opera. I mean, this guy was again more traditional sense.
Yeah,
but you know, again, standing ovations, you know, that type of stuff. But again, I go back to the obvious, which is all these names that we keep pulling out, the Lee Labradas and the, you know, the McCauways and Sean Ray and these guys, none of them ever won a posing round. Zero.
Yeah.
0 for 40, you know, whatever.
But that's more the fault of the judges, though, right, Bob? Not just necessarily the
bodybuilders. It's a fault of the system, not really the judges, because again, under the current system, if I were to take – if Kenny Jones back in the day and his all his bravado.
His plank
right?
quote, yeah.
Listen, who arguably did some entertaining routines, right?
Yeah,
I mean, the
for
guy,
sure. Yeah.
You know, he might have been half out of his mind, and obviously his physique wasn't stellar. But, you know, he would come up with some entertaining and innovative routine. If he would have won a posing round, he might have been sixth. Right? I mean, listen, that'll bring you up a long way. There's only three rounds. You won one of them. It's one third. All of a sudden, this guy's in the top 10, and you go,
yeah.
Wait a minute. How did he beat this guy and this guy? Well, he won the posing round. You can see where there's a problem there. You know what I mean? It's like, no, under the current system, there is no way. Or, again, and I use the example we just gave. If Sean Ray won the posing round in that year, 94, he would have been
yeah.
Mr. Olympia.
Right.
If Lee Labrada... Who and I thought Lee Haney was a solid poser, but I don't think there's any question Labrada was better, right? If
right.
he won 1990 or 91, whatever that year was, or 80, no, I think it was 89 in Rimini.
Rimini
if he
yeah.
had won the posing round, he beats Lee Haney to be Mr. Olympia. Now,
yeah.
again, you're a great guy to ask us. Does anybody you've ever talked to, interviewed, other than Lee Labrada himself or his wife, has anybody you've ever talked to ever had Lee Labrada beating Lee Haney in that show?
No.
No. Because by general consensus,
there's other factors, yeah.
A better bodybuilder, but should he win the Mr. Olympia title because he was a better poser?
Right.
Now we're getting away from the very essence of what the thing means. We're looking for the best body on the planet as defined by our sport.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, especially when you look at the 79, or I'm sorry, the 89 Olympia, I could see the point there, yeah, because Lee Labrada probably would have won. Because it was so close, and he did do a better
oh,
posing
yeah.
routine. His posing routine was amazing that year. So maybe
well, listen, the landscape would be much different in terms of Mr. Olympias and winners of various shows over the years if
yeah.
that was taken under consideration. But it's you know, and listen, thank God it's not. Listen, we had a tough enough time getting the right people in place sometimes. As again, I don't agree with every decision. I know you don't. It's never 100% consensus for the most part. But
yeah.
we've already got as subjective a sport as we have, so we don't need more subjectivity. You know, making it even harder to,
yeah.
you know, to get a winner.
I just thought if we brought it back, it would open it up, you know, to having these guys try harder. And because I really do think that's the artistic part of the sport. And it's, I just don't like it when I hear all these people say, oh, he won 4-3. You know, it's like a scoring contest. It's like a baseball game now or a basketball game where they're looking at the points. And I'm like, it's not points. There's more to it. There's symmetry. There's posing. There's, you know, everything. Right. You got to think, like you said, it encompasses a lot more than just seven different poses. Yeah. There's more to it than that, you know.
Of course. Yeah, listen, those are, you know, and for those listening, and again, I try to explain this in many of the shows I'm on. When they do those comparisons, John, right, you're comparing the whole body in a different pose.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing, okay? So when you say front double buys, they'll tend to look at the arms. Now, and when I say they, I'm talking about the fans out there, right, the people putting these videos together. Well, you can see in the back, they're assessing the entire physique in the back double bicep position.
Yeah.
They're assessing the entire physique in the side tricep position, and so on and so on and so on. It's the whole body is being assessed in every pose, every mandatory that you do. It's not just the arms. It's not just the legs. It's not just the anything. So, yes, to your point, it's about the whole package. You can be better overall. Like I remember years ago at a show, and I used to remember the old body part trophy days?
Best
arms, best back, best legs.
Right?
I remember a guy who won every body part trophy but lost a show.
Yeah.
And somebody said, how do you even understand how that can be? And I said, it's easy. The other guy was put together better.
Right.
He may not have been specifically better than any one of those things, but overall, he had a better physique.
Right.
And it's like, well, I know it sounds odd, but I absolutely could see it. I watched it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and another thing that's kind of changed, and I guess this is because now the Olympia is so much more than just the men, or even just when they had the men and women's bodybuilding. Now they have all these other classes and all these other divisions. But when we were talking to Sean about the 93 Olympia, I said, I read the magazine report of it, and the relaxed round, the symmetry round, which they judged, had 23 comparisons. So the judges called 23 different three-man, you know, comparisons. And then the mandatory poses had 15. So that prejudging probably lasted like 2 hours at least, you know, just for those two rounds, you know, which now they don't do because, you know, they just kind of, I don't want to say rush through it, but they do it a lot faster, you know.
Well, and again, they should be, again, they're always assessing. I like to say, again, they're not always scoring, but they're always judging.
Yeah.
All right. You don't get an individual score for every little single thing that you do out there. It doesn't mean you're not being judged. And any good trainer knows, and any good trainer worth their salt tells their people, they're always looking at you.
Yeah.
Right?
All the time.
This is what we teach people. Again, you've taught people, I've taught people, right? Listen, don't ever think they ain't looking. I don't care if you're standing in the back, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're always looking. They're always assessing in between poses, transition. You got to watch this. Keep the stomach in. You got to watch that. You don't get scored on that, right? But it comes into play when you're getting an actual score for what does come up. It doesn't mean it doesn't count. It does count. Every bit of it. The second your foot hits that stage, it counts. Mm-hmm. To the second you get off that stage. The judges are always judging, thus the name.
Right.
So.
All right, Bob. Well, before I let you go, I got to get your predictions or your early predictions for what are we like 6-7 weeks out from the Olympia this year.
I think six. Yeah, it's crazy.
Wow. Okay. So we were just on Olympia TV last week, and I think you and I both picked Lunsford to repeat.
Yeah.
So are you still going with that?
I haven't seen anything to change my mind yet. And again, I always have to start these with the proverbial caveat of look at. Of course, it depends on what they look like on game day, people. We know that, okay? We have shows to put out there. So, yeah, we do early predictions, and that's cool. Yeah. Based on what we see out there, videos that these guys put out, their training, gains they've made or whatever.
Yeah.
I haven't seen anything to indicate that Derek has done anything but got better.
He
is the incumbent champ. He's the defending champ. And listen, you know, I hate to use the expression because I've always hated this expression. But, yeah, you do kind of have to knock out the champ in terms of being better. You know, but I've always countered my dad saying, but you know, you only got to beat him by 1 point. The question is where can Hottie make up that point? Because what you saw from last year, he wasn't able to do that. Now, Hottie's fate might be in Hottie's hands because he is extremely muscular and very difficult, with that conditioning level that he gets. He's going to be in the mix. Derek, I suspect, is going to be even better than he was last year, which is going to make him very formidable to repeat. Yeah. Samson is still solid. I still think Samson has the best physique. I like the taller guy. I like the symmetry, his proportion, his shape better. Mm-hmm. Just what we were talking about, John, right?
Yeah.
Samson's fate is in Samson's hands. I said this before, and I'll say it again. He's got stuff that those guys can't get. He can get what they got, or we hope he can get what they got, but they can't get what he's got. That's the difference. than Samson Dauda, because he's got better shape, symmetry, proportion, all that kind of stuff. His display, his presentation is fantastic. It's only a matter of conditioning. He doesn't have to be 100%, but he can't be 90%. He has to get the 95 percentile in order to have, it not be a detriment, because those guys are ripped to the bone. They are hard. They are dense. They are grainy. So he's just got to get grainy enough. He doesn't have to beat them in that particular box you got to check, but he can't be so far off either that it becomes blatant. So otherwise he'll be back in third.
Yeah.
He's got the best physique out of all of them. That said, now you get in the fourth and fifth and the landscape has changed. We certainly have to talk about Nick Walker. Yes, he's a mutant, right? He's a freak. We all get that stuff, okay? But he is lacking in those three departments, shape, symmetry, and proportion. Automatically kind of puts him on the outside looking in,
yeah,
because you got a guy named Andrew Jack who just emerged, who's made significant progress, who looked absolutely phenomenal in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a physique worthy of being compared into that top three, four, five.
Yeah.
So he's going to be there and he's going to be pushing against them. And we haven't even brought up some of these other names. Labrada is going to be competing overseas this week. He's looking as thick as ever. I think he lacks a little in the separation department and symmetry, proportion, that type of thing. He's very thick. And then the muscle he's put on, I think at this point, he's got to be careful, because like Bonac, again, another name we can't count out. Brandon Curry, we haven't even mentioned. He's a former Mr. Olympia. Can't mm-hmm. count him out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you've got eight guys vying for five spots at the top.
Yeah.
We don't know if Big Rami's competing. I haven't seen anything to indicate that he is. So we don't see a return from Big Rami. I don't see it. I haven't seen any upstate videos. I haven't seen any, I did see him personally last month, and he's big. He's Big Rami, right? But
yeah,
I don't think it would be a bad thing for him to take his two Olympias and go out there and go be the mayor, and that's cool. But
you got Bayrouz and you got, like you said, Martin, so those guys could be coming in.
Again, I can't take Martin out because he could have beaten Nick. Right. So I got to put him up there.
Right.
Bayrouz, God willing, he can get here. And I hope he certainly can, because, again, this guy's a talent. I don't think he's quite there yet to compete with the top three or four, but he can easily be five, six, or seven.
Yeah.
So I think those are your top guys. And then you still got guys we haven't even discussed. You got Big Akeem. You got some guys with some muscle out there. Correct me if I'm forgetting anybody, because we're off the top of our heads here. But
yeah. No, I think you hit the top guys. Are there one or two guys you think do better on stage than other guys? Like, it seems like Hunter, no disrespect, but he seems like whenever he gets to the Olympia, he kind of fades a little bit. We have big expectations of him. Nick typically has done very well on stage. He's very aggressive. Hadi is a guy I would think that when he gets up there, he's ready to fight and he's ready to battle. Yeah. He's got that onstage persona. I mean, we've seen that at the Arnold this year, where he was so ready and so ripped, and he really wants to win.
Nick seems to get better as he goes. Hadi gets better as he goes.
Yeah.
Hunter gets better as he goes. The problem with Hunter is he starts off behind the eight ball.
Yeah.
He comes out and he's usually holding some water for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And I've seen this at multiple shows, multiple reasons why that would be. And he starts to lose the water. But at that level, you don't have time to lose. Like, you can't – you're automatically going to kind of get shoved into the second or third call out. And you've got to work your way back up, which is very difficult while you're getting better.
Yeah.
Other people are getting better. So Hunter, if he can come out smoking, let's not forget, he took fourth just a couple of years ago. So, I mean, Hunter is no
one, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he beat Nick, right?
Yeah,
so, I mean, it's, listen, these guys are all a hair away from each other. And it's literally a game of inches on game day as to who comes in dry. Hunter has to hit the ground running. He has to. He can't afford to come in there and be holding water, and he's sweating bullets, and he's going to get better. I've seen him get better at every show, but it's very difficult to make up ground at the Olympia level.
Yeah.
You got Rafael Brandão, another guy in there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Very well put together. Certainly a spoiler. He could do very well in there, depending on how he comes in. He's very complete, which is good and bad. There's nothing really outstanding, which you think would be a hallmark of bodybuilding, but sometimes you kind of need an outstanding part or two to separate yourself from the pack, because these guys are so good.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned on the Olympia TV show we did last week, I mean, I'm kind of pulling for Andrew. It's just because he's got that amazing physique. But again, a lot of it is, you know, the condition that he displays on that day and also the attitude he brings to the stage. He kind of seems a little bit laid back sometimes, doesn't he, Bob, with his posing and everything? I'd like to come up there really like
he's a little chill. I'd like to see him, you know, with a little fist pumping out there.
Kind too, of, yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But I tell you what, man, the physique that you just saw in Texas is a different physique than we saw the year before.
Man, I was really
this guy has filled out that frame finally, and he is dangerous.
Yeah.
At 6'2", and you know, he looks like a Mr. Olympia, and
yeah,
he ain't missing much.
Yeah.
I know they like to, you know, his hamstrings and this and that. Listen, everybody's missing something. Everybody could have a little better this or that, and nobody's 100% perfect.
Yeah.
Okay. So you got to take it for a grain of salt. Listen, I like the taller physique. I can absolutely, and let me tell you something. If Samson and Andrew can establish some dominance right off the bat, they'll dictate the flow of where it goes. It's all about comparison at that level. A big man will bring another big man up.
Yeah.
Those short dudes out there, and they're all about the same height. Well, they can dictate it the other way because they got that thick muscle. And they got that conditioning, and they'll make the taller guys look a little off. You know what I mean? For lack, like they need more muscle.
Yeah.
So they kind of go in packs. It's like a wolf pack here, you know, type of a thing.
Yeah.
So if the big guys can establish right off the bat, that helps the big guys.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be a really, really exciting show. I think this show is going to be one of the most exciting Olympias we've seen in a while. And it just seems like it gets more and more exciting every year because these guys are bringing their game up, man. And the competition is incredible.
Sure does. I tell you what, I'm looking forward to it. I do hope Belarus can get here because I hate to see politics come into play.
Yeah,
you know, nationwide, you know, type of stuff where it's nobody's fault. It's just, listen, it's where he's from.
Yeah.
It's the process. It's all that. So I hope that he can kind of get that squared away. And then I haven't heard any word either way. He's got 6 weeks. If I could get over here tomorrow, if I'm him, I'd get here.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, like Hadi, I think Hadi just came over, right? He came over to the United States already, so he's
smartly ready. Again. He's been over a number of times, but I would leave nothing to chance with Iran and how they work that stuff over there. But if I'm Belarus and I can get over here, again, the guy's a talent. He's a lot bigger than people think he is, and he's good. He needs a few things, but by the same token, there's nothing that he can't fix. He's a relatively young guy in the game, and he can make those improvements, but he can make a splash in his first Olympia if he can get her.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Bob. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. I'm glad we finally got you on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast.
And, sure.
I hope we can get you on again one day and talk some more old school bodybuilding. And we'll look forward to seeing you at the Olympia this year as the voice of bodybuilding.
Absolutely.
On that stage. And we're looking forward to that show as well.
Sounds good, buddy. Anytime. We can debate the 81 Olympia or whatever. It's always fun.
Right. Yeah. We got a lot of old school stuff to talk about, right?
Sure do, buddy.
Okay. Thanks again, Bob. I appreciate it.
All right, John. We'll catch up.
Right. Take care. Bye-bye. All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to Bob Ciccarillo for joining us on the show. And thank you to all your Patreon donors who continue to sponsor the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I appreciate your support. All right. So before I let you guys go, I want to read this article that comes from the April 1988 issue of Flex Magazine. And this was, I believe, was the first mainstream article on Bob Ciccarillo. It was written by J.M. Mannion. And it says, the junior nationals champ doesn't train for second place. Bob Ciccarillo, pronounced Ciccarillo, is known as the youngest old timer at Samson's Gym in Rochester, New York. He's only 22, but he's been a bodybuilder for the past 9 years. It seems that Bob is following the precedent set by other famous bodybuilders who've come from Rochester, most notably Danny Padilla and Gold's Gym's Pete Kromkowski. Two tough acts to follow, but Bob's career so far shows that he'll have no problem becoming a name in the future. Bob has been involved in athletics since he was 7, mainly football and baseball. He never considered weight training until he saw pumping iron and was immediately inspired by the physiques of Arnold Schwarzenegger and Lou Ferrigno. Bob trained in his basement for a year, and then he visited Samson's Gym, and he's been a member ever since. When he was 14, he entered his first show at 14. It was the 1980 Teen Monroe County competition where he placed 8th. I didn't place last, though, so that was a big motivational factor, Bob states. The next year at 15, he entered the Teen Lake Ontario, and he won. That was a major feat for me, Bob says, since I was so young and I trained for such a short time. And contrary to what people think, I was natural throughout my teen years.
In 82, he conquered the Team Monroe County. From there, his competitive career took off. Chikorilla won the Team New York Ontario and the Team Niagara District. The next year saw him winning the Team Northeast and the Team Rochester. For 84, the Team Empire State and the Team New York State were added to his resume of titles. The Team Gold's Gym Classic of Rochester in 85 was his next win, along with the second place at the heavyweight class of the Team Nationals, which I believe Sean Ray won. Then Bob took 2 years off from competition. And he came back with a bang in 87. He won the Junior Nationals, and he placed fifth in the heavyweights at the Men's Nationals. The competition was fierce in the heavies with plenty of great champions. I'm really happy with my placing, especially since it was my first crack at the big one, says Bob, about the 87 Nationals. Early on, he faced a tough decision. Should he continue with other sports or devote all his time to weight training? At one point, West Virginia University wanted to offer him a football scholarship. There were his parents to contend with, too. They were skeptical because, as Bob says, in 79, bodybuilding wasn't generally accepted. The decision wasn't as quick as his 4.5-second record in the 40-yard dash, but it was made. Bob felt that with his genetics and talent, bodybuilding was his best sport. His parents are very supportive now since learning more about it. Not that life has been trouble-free ever since. He says, I think people at the gym had mixed feelings about my wins. I think they resented my youth or thought the contests were fixed. Another rumor was that I was on steroids. A lot of friends have come and gone because of my bodybuilding. They see I'm going places in life and they'd like to be in my shoes. This could get me down, but I'm the type of person who likes to share my victories with everybody. One of Bob's most lasting friendships is with Jim Rockell, the owner of Samson's Gym and the MPC New York West District Chairman. Bob has known Rock, as he calls him, since he joined Samson's. Back then, Rockell was still competing, so they traveled together to contest. He also helps Bob out with his diet and posing. Bob puts it best when he says, I have lots of respect for Jim as a friend and businessman. He puts Samson's Gym on the bodybuilding map. Two other good friends are Bob's training partners, Tony Camaretta and Lou DeVideo. Tony is a chiropractor, which Bob says comes in handy, and a longtime friend. Bob and Lou have been training together on and off for 4 years. Both men really push him to train intensely. What does it take to refine Bob's 6 foot, 213-pound frame for a contest? Plenty of hard work, he declares. Bob's pre-contest diet and training begins 12 weeks before a show. His diet is divided into 3 4-week groups. In the first 4 weeks, red meat, milk, and cheese, junk foods, and cereal products are cut. During the second period, he cuts out butter and all seasoning, while for the final 4 weeks, Bob becomes extremely strict. He says he cuts everything during this period. He doesn't find dieting hard because he's disciplined and he chooses to do it. Bob prepares most of his own meals, and his parents usually diet right along with him. To be blunt, Bob says, I like winning better than I like eating. Training consists of a 4-day-on, 1-day-off double-split routine. Mondays in the morning, he trains biceps and then bicycling, and then in the PM, he trains chest and abs. Tuesday, he does triceps in the morning and back at night. Wednesday, shoulders in the morning and quads and calves at night. And Thursday, hamstrings in the morning and abs and bicycling at night. Bob feels his legs are too big a muscle group to train all in one day. As for the part of his life that's not spent in the gym, Bob feels he couldn't have a better job. He just started as a deputy sheriff for Monroe County, providing security in courtrooms. His work schedule allows him to train because it's a 9-to-5 job with no overtime, no weekend work, and paid holidays. And it's usually easy to get time off for contests. For the 87 Nationals, Bob almost had to stay back in Rochester because he accepted the job just 2 weeks before the contest and was expected to report for 4 weeks of training. He couldn't arrange time off for the Friday prejudging because all trainees were required to be present Monday through Friday from 7:45 a.m. to 4 p.m., and that's it. No exceptions. His only hope was that the heavyweight class wouldn't go on until late in the evening. As it turned out, his father got him a 5 p.m. flight. Bob arrived in Philadelphia at 6 p.m., and his family, who were already at the contest, picked him up and drove him back to Atlantic City. Bob was relieved to find the middleweight class still on stage when he arrived. Wow, that's crazy. Now he's finished his job training, he foresees no more scheduling problems for contest. Future plans are for Chickamania to run wild. For the uninitiated, this is the nickname Bob's friends gave him. They've even had shirts printed. Expect to see Chickamania in full force in Las Vegas, Nevada for the 88 USA Championships. I'm going to Las Vegas to win, he says, because I don't train for second place. All right. All right. Good article about Bob Chicarillo way back in the day. Chickamania. All right, guys. Well, that's it for another episode of Bodybuilding Legends. We will hopefully be back next week for another episode. I've got one guest that I've been working on that I think you guys will like. It's an old AAU star. I'll let you wonder who that is. I don't want to jinx it, though, so hopefully he'll be with us either next week or the week after. All right, until next week, train hard, stay safe, and we'll see you guys next week. All right, take care. Bye.